Welcome back to the second Q&A episode of The Gearheart. I'm your reader, writer, and host, Alex White. I put out a call on the blog for questions from the listeners, and you all enthusiastically answered. I don't think I've ever been so excited about the response to the show. I'm going to answer all the questions in a very non-spoilerific way here. You may absolutely listen without fear of ruining the story. So, settle in, pour a cup of tea, and enjoy, as I bring you the responses to your questions. Casey Horn asks, as a sculptor working with calligraphy in different languages, I'm drawn to the idea you use regarding empowering individuals with arcane energy through the use of written glyphs and symbols. What known language do you see your characters using, or what language does it most closely resemble? This was asked by Casey Horn of CaseyHorn.com, and also Rick and John Frost echoed his sentiments. See, this is a fascinating question, especially from a guy as talented as Casey Horn. If you haven't seen his sculpture and other art, you can head over to his website, CaseyHorn.com, and see lots of really interesting stuff. So to answer your question, I always thought that the script of the glyphs varied from character to character based on their personalities. Augustus's glyphs might look like the wire patterns of a circuit board, whereas Isabel's might seem Arabic, flowing like fire. Darren's would probably have the precision of kanji and the simplicity of hiragana, and Keegan's would probably resemble Assyrian cuneiform. I think Maeve would be really interesting with pink, elegant Sanskrit glyphs. As I said, the glyph needs to be a part of the personality of the character, and no two would be alike. Now let's work a response to the Gearheart challenges in here. Everyone asked me where they went after they were gone, and I must admit I missed them too. To make a long story short, I felt that they weren't really geared toward the audiobook format, since many of you were listening long after the original release. In an effort not to turn off listeners, I figured they had to go. However, this venue is perfect. So, on with the challenge. The challenge was, if you had a steampunk organization, what would you be called? What would you do? Most importantly, what would you name your flagship Zeppelin? Nancy Brown writes, I think I'd like to start a bar/tavern/inn in the real world that's all steampunk themed. Perhaps the Jade Pixie or something. I think I also like the Foggy Goggles. Maybe it could be an attached coffee shop. Too bad Minnesota isn't really the best place for that. Nancy, there is such a heaven here on Earth. It's called the Edison, and it's an extremely upscale steampunk bar in downtown L.A. When I visited L.A. last October, I visited the Edison and saw its many wonders, and the bartender knew who I was, which was always a plus. A fantastic chap named Michael served me a glass of 16-year Lagavulin, and let me tell you, he was generous with the poor. Fantastic place, you'll love it. Look up edisondowntown.com. Also, if you're interested in seeing some of Nancy's positively wonderful artwork, look it up at DeviantArt. Her username is ToasterBot. That's ToasterB0T. Let's get another question. The Seeker organization is described as a secret organization, so the world at large isn't aware of magic? If not, what are the implications to the Seekers of the recent events in Cerceval? This was asked by Ben Hummel, our sculptor and one of our two fan artists who does just a fantastic job on everything. Well, Ben, the Seekers are not as secret as they would like to believe. The scene with Keegan and Greta proves that fact, as she's not a Seeker and she's actively trying to recruit someone. On top of all that, there is a lot of unaffiliated magic floating around, such as the Hangman and Wallaby Buskerton and Crust. I really appreciate that you brought up recent events in Cerceval, and let's not forget Keldinorn. No spoilers, but in sequels, that chain of events is the catalyst that changes everything. It'll be a different landscape to be sure, and I can't wait to work on it more. Ben also asked, what is Uncle Milton's knowledge of the Seekers and Cog? Well, Ben, good catch on an extremely minor character. Milton knows everything, but he's more or less sworn to secrecy. He and Jonathan are the ones that discovered Cog, and he is aware of much of Jonathan's comings and goings. Keep listening for some interesting news about that character later in this episode. Let's get another challenge response, this one from Judah. He says that they would be called the Shadow Dwellers. They would look to overthrow unfriendly dictators, break up crime families, and basically be the not-so-bad guys. Our Zeppelin would be green and black and be named the Fedora. Very cool. I'll look to see the tale in the latest issue of my favorite pulp mag. Here's another question. If the government knows about the Seekers, isn't there likely to be a leak? This was asked by Jim. Jim, there's an extreme likelihood of leaks in that situation. Every bureaucracy has spies, and the government of Gelset is no different. The only way to protect the Seekers is from within. Most world governments are at least somewhat aware of their existence, but the actual nature of their power isn't as well known. Couple that with the security provided by the Queensmen, and the potentially harmful leaks stopped by the foresight of the Seeress, and you have a system that is about as airtight as it gets. As an example, we're all aware of Special Operations Command, or SOCOM, but very few of us are actually informed as to their current activities. Enemy governments would be completely in the know about them, but not necessarily about what they do or what their capabilities are. Let's get another challenge response. Black Saber writes, "They'd be called Dixon's Dirigible Depot, a mobile armory in the sky. We'd stock bullets, rifle slides, scopes, slings, arrows, bows, med kits, maps, and more. I say, what about sharp sticks? You know, the kind for popping toy zeppelins?" Here's another question. This is something I've always wondered about. The creature that Jonathan meets in the vision in Episode 9, the creature with the strange snout, was that creature based on the ancient Egyptian deity named Set, who is always depicted as a human with the head of a strange creature with a long, trunk-like snout? Set was the god of storms, darkness, destruction, decay, and chaos. So, are the similarities a coincidence, or was it deliberate? This was asked by Johnny A., and then echoed by Nancy Brown. I have to say, it wasn't deliberate. I wish it was, that would be awesome. My inspiration for the successor creatures was based in two places, H.P. Lovecraft and the art of Sam Keith. Some of you may remember Keith's art from the 90s comic, The Max. The animals he drew in the Outback were so terrifyingly alien, similar to some of the creatures from the much later Half-Life 2 video game. I also really liked Lovecraft's basic concept of something that was the total opposite of human or earthly. A lot of his creatures, such as the Mego or the Fungi from Ugoth, had adapted along a wholly different evolutionary path, and it drove me to ask the question, what would that look like? In fact, I'm not even sure that the creatures from the Gearheart are carbon-based. I mean, for all we know, they're inorganic polymers animated by electrical storms, and, you know, I like it that way. This challenge response comes from Kyle Dockery, who I understand is working on his own steampunk setting. I expect him to come up with some really cool things in the future. His organization would be named Kualima, which means death. "We would be sky pirates to the core, never letting a government or other organization stand in our way. My flagship would be called Lutarha, which means bone garden for all you non-Suomi speakers out there. Also, our theme song would be the opener from Firefly. I know that wasn't a question, but hey, had to add it." Well, that is a pretty good song. If you ever catch the commentary from Firefly, they can't stop singing it every time it comes on. "What were your aspirations for the Gearheart?" asks John Frost. "There seemed to be a lot of anime in there, such as Fullmetal Alchemist." I grew up watching any and all anime as it became available. I can still remember when we had to go to the local CD store just to pay $40 for a single lousy video cassette. Among my favorites were Akira, Gunsmith Cats, Ghost in the Shell, Escaflowne, and Rurouni Kenshin. Yes, I know Kenshin is cheesy. I love it, and I don't care. My wife used to totally make fun of me.
Still do!
I started working on the Gearheart in 99, and the influence of anime was ridiculously heavy. At the time, I thought it was the only medium out there worth watching, and I spent every waking minute immersed in its oversaturated glow. However, as time went on, I started to see a lot of patterns, and I realized it was just as cheesy as American stuff. I think a lot of anime writers think of the aesthetic before the story, and I started to see that it really suffered from that attitude. As the years went by, I fell out of the fan base, and subsequent revisions of the Gearheart got darker and more realistic. I still wanted to keep the mystery that you feel in your heart when you see two samurai duel under a snow of cherry blossoms, but I also wanted to make sure that I told the story in my own voice. Nowadays, I have a very love-hate relationship with anime. I feel compelled to judge it based on the quality of the writing and not the beauty of the art. There are still some good ones out there, but they don't influence me quite so much. Jim asks, "Your wife is awesome with the female voices. Was it always your plan to do it this way, or did you plan a full voice cast?" Well, originally I planned to do a straight read, kicking around somewhere I have 6 episodes where it's just me reading and I even do the girl voices. After some feedback from my beta readers, however, I decided it was time to rewrite the beginning and add about 40 pages of new content. After that, I started at square one and Renee said she really wanted to help out. I'm really glad I took her up on her offer. I don't really like the idea of a full cast because I like to direct pretty heavily. It makes me nervous to think that I might have to call someone up, someone who's doing me a very generous favor, and say, "I didn't like that reading, can we re-record?" It's not fair to them, and it's not fair to the listeners to put out a low-quality product, so it's kind of a rock in a hard place. For future projects, I'll be using more local talent. I have a couple of great actors and actresses that I'll be calling into the studio to handle some more roles, but I can never truly be full cast. There's simply too many characters in my stories for me to be comfortable with the idea. On a side note, I'm terrified that I'll accidentally put one of my girl readings into the podcast because I overlook it or forget to edit it out. When I record, I don't stop for any reason, and I have Renee come in and dub everything afterward. However, I'm sure everyone would be shocked to hear my terrible cog voice. Gil Smoke asks, "Would I consider letting people make derivative projects for the Gearheart?" I'm afraid not, Mr. Smoke. I haven't told all the stories that I want to tell in the universe, and I wouldn't want someone messing up canon. There's also the fear that the publisher would be less attracted to the franchise if anyone and everyone had the right to make derivative works. Once you make a release like that, you can never take it back. Writers should exercise caution when considering their Creative Commons license. The protocol seems friendly enough, but the implications are huge. Be very careful before releasing rights because it's irrevocable. Publication is the reason I sought to podcast in the first place, and I wouldn't want to mess that up. Black Saber and Ashley both asked, "What is my next project?" Well, I have numerous other projects in the works, but I can guarantee you that you'll see my next book, Festival of the Bazaar, on podiobooks.com later this year. It's a story in the near future about a couple of highly trained hitmen who are hired to kill a famous idol singer. Instead of a payment, however, they're relentlessly hunted at every turn by dangerous paramilitary forces. In the end, they have to learn the identity of those who hired them if the group wants a chance at survival. It's like a murder mystery with a twist. We know the killers and the victims, but we want to learn the motives. The story is raunchy and irreverent, sexy and full of action. Hopefully it won't make all of you quit listening to me. When it launches, I'll put it up at festivalofthebazaar.com and make an announcement and promo in this feed. I plan to record most of it before I even start posting, though, so it may be a while. I'm thinking of a 3rd quarter launch. Rest assured, I'll keep you all up to date. Gil Smoke, Jim, and countless others have asked me, am I going to write more stories in the Gearheart universe? And, of course, is there a prequel? I get this question a lot, and I totally understand. I like to keep the window kind of open and make it look like there's so much more in the universe than what I've just said. And to be fair, there is, but I don't particularly enjoy a lot of expository dialogue, and I try to avoid it at all costs. What I can say is, rest assured, I absolutely am going to tell more Gearheart stories. The original story, The Clockwork Girl, was the feature-length screenplay of how Jonathan met Cog and helped to save her from the Antonellos. My next podcast is Festival of the Bazaar, but I plan on novelizing the original story and working out a lot of the plot holes. So after Festival, you'll get to hear the prequel. And of course, the prequel involves a lot of the character Milton Andrews, so that should answer a lot of your questions, Ben. I also wanted to let you know that I'm working on a spin-off short story called Maiden Flight of the Avenger. It'll become available fairly soon, and I'm hoping to compose an original score for it. Details will appear in this feed, so stay tuned. Well, that's all the time I have for this Q&A. I just wanted to save the best for last. I got this ridiculously epic challenge response from Mr. James Keeling, and it is quite lengthy. So enjoy. Until next time, listeners. James writes,
"How you ask? How do I ever manage to find crew for my zeppelin, the Scarlet Corset, for the truly insane and dangerous adventures we have found ourselves on? Well, take a seat, by the round, and allow me to regale you. Barkeep, another. Down by the docks, lad, that's where you want to be. That's where the spelunkers of the skies are to be found. Find you a nice drinking establishment. None too clean, mind you, but neither should it be the bottom of the barrel. That's where I go. Approach the door, adjust your duster, and shake off the excess rainwater. I tell you true, you're no better waterproofing than engine grease, bar none. With a healthy jaunt, enter and sidle up to the bar. You're a flyer, I see, they would say to me. Aye, and truly so, I would reply. The intended rings which me goggles leave about me eyes be a tell more obvious than the copper circlet of wetlock upon a finger, a digit which in my case shall remain forever unadorned, cause the scarlet corset, well, lad, she be my mate, my lover, my companion, and with her only may I truly escape these bound and chained streets. But back to me tale. Now that you're at the bar, get yourself a pint of the best local ale they've got. Always drink the local, lad. It builds rapport and opens more doors than it closes. This here is when I would go into me spiel. Invariably, someone will ask what brings me to these particular parts. To the room in general, I would sound heartily, in me Zeppelin, the mighty scarlet corset, I proselytize the ignorant. I spread the truth of steam, the power of the gear. Ain't nothing like the hiss of power from a steam engine, that's primal power true enough. I would exhort the crowd, raising my clenched fist into the air. It's water what powers a man as the High One himself designed it, and water is what will take us into the next stage and beyond. A general murmur of consensus always follows this proclamation. They now be primed. Would you believe that there exists, to this very day, in this modern age of ours, villages without the blessings of modern steam-driven wells, without the machinery to efficiently till their fields or mine their copper? Nay, it cannot be so, they would exclaim in horror, that such poor individuals can be forced to endure such an accursed existence. I bring with me, aboard my lady, the scarlet corset, pipes, gears, cogs, and all manner of technology, all she can be laden with, all for the furtherance of a good deed done to those less fortunate than you or I. But we don't go it alone. With us ride a few daring souls, with the knowledge and the will to see these provisions put to good use. Those who wish to ply the skyways and seek fortune across the horizon. The crew of the Scarlet Corset! I've had scholars fly with me, artisans, pipe fitters, and a few of the mechanical genius to spread the word through deed and action. Aye, even royalty has flown beneath my flag. Some are with me but a short time, others much longer, but any who leave take with them the kind of satisfaction that may only be gained by putting your hand to the wheel and your shoulder to the capstan. I'll not lie, it's a hard tack at times, and occasionally, dare I say often, we find ourselves alee and beset upon by those with less than noble intentions. But the Scarlet Corset, well, she be ready for those times right enough. Now, laddie, it's about this time that I reel in the net. That, my friends, is what brings me to this fine establishment this very eve. It seems I have a berth or two aboard the Scarlet Corset. So if you have a fire in your boiler that screams for adventure and a yearning thirst you cannot slake, well then I be nothing here but your humble servant, Xavier Hawthorne, Captain of the Scarlet Corset. So what do you say, lads and lasses? Are you up to the challenge? And that was James's challenge response.